Like getting booed all season long every time you touch the ball and then hoisting MLS Cup for the very first time. It's That's So MLS. I'm one of your hosts, Nick, and with me, as always, is Andrew Bates.
Hello, how are you doing?
Excellent. How are you doing, by the way, after yesterday?
I'm doing great. I am back in Toronto. I went to MLS Cup yesterday, the final. I had the journey of getting a ticket to this game was almost as lengthy a process as watching the game itself.
Yeah.
When you take the whole week into account.
Indeed. So break it down for us, because you talked about it a little bit on the show, but you sort of decided a couple of weeks ago, or you'd been talking for like a month or so of maybe going to the final if it was in Toronto. Where you used to live.
Yes.
And sort of once we knew Toronto was going to be in, then you started looking in earnest for tickets.
Basically, at that time, so the Seattle was confirmed, I think, on a Wednesday. And the deadline for submitting press passes was that Friday at 5 p.m. EST, which I learned at 6 p.m. EST. last year, it was the second straight year in BMO Field, and there was some complaints of it. There were too many scalpers on general on sale at that time. I don't think that there was still a couple hundred seats that ended up on StubHub. I think the club's method of trying to deal with this was opening pre-sale to season seat holders as much as possible.
Right.
Because there was the initial on, there were several different sets of pre-sales, and there was no last year there was a pre-sale for members of the mailing list, and there was no such thing this year. And it literally sold out in a minute. There were no tickets available 1 minute after. What you kind of had to dig really deep to learn when the general on sale was. Because they never once tweeted about it. They never once made an announcement that, like, right. Hey, this is when you can come get your tickets.
Right.
You had to, like, be following three different Twitter accounts and doing the constant searches.
Yeah.
So I was trying... Pardon, what were you going to say?
No.
When I got into town, what worked for me last year, I sat in the Seattle away-in because I was a Vancouver fan. Seattle fans were much more amenable to have me by.
Right.
And also, like last year, they were the only ones willing to sell generally at face value.
Right.
Because essentially, you sign up for the lottery, you don't know if you can travel for sure, you don't know you can buy the plane ticket. You win the lottery, and then you realize you don't have you can't fly, so all of a sudden you have a ticket you can't use.
Right.
Or you had four friends, and then one of your friends dropped out, so now you have an extra ticket. So I tried. When I got into town, I had an agreement, I thought, with a guy that was going to sell general tickets that he had purchased the Seattle Fan for $300, and then learned that he was thinking it was going to be – we found him in the hotel, and he held up two tickets and said, which one do you want?
Oh.
Myself and my partner Lauren, we said, this is not what we thought we were going to do. We're not ready to pay $600 total for this.
Yeah.
For this interaction. So I just kept searching Twitter, searching Kijiji, searching StubHub. Still the day of, there were a lot of tickets on StubHub. In the overnight it didn't shift, but during the day it shifted from like 400 tickets to like 200 tickets by the time we got down to the stadium.
Right.
There were once I posted an ad saying I was looking for some, I got a lot of messages from people in Winnipeg being like, sure, I got tickets, just send me all your money and then I'll send them right over.
Yeah. Tickets for sure. Taylor Swift, right? No.
Which is unfortunate. It's unfortunate that I also know that nobody wants to send their thing before they get paid either. So it's kind of like an unfortunate deal of who's going to jump in on the pool first.
Yeah, of course.
When you're not using sort of one of the more official services, and eventually, as I did with the guy who bought his tickets on StubHub and wanted to get them for $600, I sent messages to a couple other people saying, I could buy these tickets for $300. They said, we can't do that. And I said, well, if it gets closer to the game, you let me know.
Yeah.
With my reasoning being that actually you need us more than we need you, because somebody had given me free tickets to the viewing party in Liberty Village. I could have a wonderful time and I would have $150.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and also the tickets are worth nothing if you don't sell them, right? So whatever they purchased them for, you know, if they got them from somebody else, you know, I think there's a fair amount of like rescalping that goes on as well. You know, they might have had a connection and bought them for $150 each, and now they want to turn around and double that again. But if it gets down close enough to the wire, there's surely going to be a certain number of people. And you see it all the time with scalpers where, you know, they're basically selling tickets cheaper than what you would have paid at the box office for them because they just need to get rid of them and get something back.
So we made it down by this. We went to Liberty Village. The line for the viewing party was stretching around the thing. There was a vague promise for anyone that got in early that you could win tickets to get in early, and a lot of people were lined up. But it was no ins, no outs. So we thought we've got to go hit the stadium first.
Right.
There were no scalpers. There were a number of people that had signs that say "I need tickets" as opposed to selling tickets. But I feel like they kind of cleared the perimeter because all the only people that were around the stadium were these sponsor tents.
Which is also where you ran into a rather celebrated MLS individual who was not playing on the day, but just happened to be there for some reason.
Right. We passed by all these tents, which include a big black murder box from Adidas that's like an augmented reality thing to promote their Predator line of shoes.
Right.
And people are like, would you like to go into the murder box?
Can like, I just no, have I a shoe think. Instead?
There was also a DHL truck, and like it was a promotion where I think you could get like a TFC sweatshirt, and you had to line up to go into the truck, and they would hand you like a DHL shipping envelope that had the free thing in it. And I was like, wow, a lot of these would just be like horror movie set up.
Just
step into my truck and I'll give you a free a t-shirt. Just
get into the truck, remove your clothing, and see what you win.
But as we passed first, there was this, you know, take a picture for BlackBerry or whatever else. And we walked to the stadium. We're pretty sure we're not seeing any scalpers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really want to go deposit my money and roll the dice on PayPal.
Yeah.
We are in a draw for Allstate, and we walk back to the Allstate tent. And there is Tim Melia sitting at a table, goalkeeper of the year for Sporting Kansas City, in his sweater, just signing autographs. And I'm like, just like chilling out and hanging out with BlackBerry. For some reason, I'm like, I just shake my head. And I'm like, what?
Which I think, I mean, that kind of would have been a cool experience, even if he hadn't got the tickets, to just be like, you just randomly run into Tim Melia.
Yeah. No, it's great. I congratulated him on his year. Tried not to take up too much of his time because everybody wanted autographs, and then didn't win the tickets. Was thinking, I think this might not happen. We should maybe think about wandering back to Liberty Village. And then I got a message from Gus, my man Gus, who was like, "Yeah, actually, I can do $300. Where are you?" And I'm like, "We have the cash. We're by BMO Field. Come meet us right away." And then we realized that we had actually spent, because we took the cash out for the previous evening's Seattle fan, and then we definitely used $40 of that for a cab coming home from karaoke. So we were like, actually, we have $260 in 20s and 2 5s and a bunch of change. And Gus, that saint, was like, "Yeah, fine, that's great."
Oh man, Gus, what a hero! So every trophy has its hero, and sounds like what a guy, Gus.
What a guy Gus is. So, and the seats were like $110, and so it really was only like a $30-$40 premium, which was not what a lot of people were paying.
Sure.
On StubHub. And we get the printed tickets in our hands, and my thought immediately is, we have to get to the gates right now, because these can be fake, and I need to know right away.
Yeah, yeah.
I just need, I've spent so much time working the wires that I just need to get into the stadium now.
You just want to hear that satisfying little beep on the machine and just know that it's valid, and I just want access to be able to pay $10 for a sippy cup of Budweiser.
It was like winning, it was like we did win the, as a joke on Twitter, the Internet Conference Champions. We did it!
I was good. I didn't even need to watch the game after that. Once I found that out, and I knew that I'd get to hear the story, I was kind of like, you know, I think I'm spent. I think this was all the action, all the drama, the late twists, the heroics. That's all I really needed.
And I'm pretty sure there were a couple of extra seats around us, too, that were not sold. But mostly it was a sellout. There were no, like, big chunks of seats. It was just that, like, there were probably the two next to us just were empty, which gave us a lot of room to stand, which was nice. That was a good part of it. I've sat up in that area before, and in any stadium's issue with atmosphere is that the supporters love to the supporter sections are fun, and then sometimes the other sections, especially in the upper bowl, are not playing ball the same way. And there was actually, like, I think to the back of our section there were about 7 rows of people who were standing, and then like everyone else in the front of the section was sitting, and then the people on both sides were sitting as the game was beginning, and some old guy was trying to be like, sit down, and nobody did, but it was nice. So
yeah,
it was,
I sort of feel bad for that. Like the guy, or, I mean, cause I sit in a supportive section as well. So I know what it's like. You get people who are not familiar with it. And even though it's printed on their ticket and there's signs and everything, you get two people that like plop down with their $80 nachos and this big tray of food, and they sit down. And almost as soon as they get comfortable, everybody stands up and there's flags and stuff. Mm-hmm. And you could just see them sort of exchange that look about with, like, do we say something?
But it was good. Everybody was reasonably into it. As I think you will get at many different times, there were a couple people right behind us that were sharing their opinion throughout the match.
Yes. Constantly.
But generally everything was good. There was a fight like 3 or 4 rows ahead of us that there was like a scarf cam, like Continental, who was handing out free MLS Cup scarves before, was like, show us your scarves, and like pointing around at everybody. And I think that people, this is my best read on the situation, somebody was trying to stand up and I guess fell down and then took issue with the people behind them, like they had caused an interference that resulted in this. And then
they were looking for a penalty, Andrew. They were just looking for a penalty shout.
They were looking for a penalty
point to
shout.
The spot. Video review.
There was no video review. There was only handbags that got the attention of the entire. There was just some pushing back and forth between about like 2 sets of 4 people in the entire section. I was just like, time to get out of here. And walking down the steps, and as I was getting down the steps, it was like 20 rows down, people were looking up like, what's going on with these assholes?
Yeah. They're at every game. I always find it funny, the fans, like, I get going to a football game and enjoying some beverages, but you see people that, like, show up 20 minutes into a match, immediately start causing problems, and you're like, why did you come here? Like, just stay at the bar. Like, clearly, you didn't need the rest of this stadium experience, and it's too much for you to handle. Like, usually I get drinking at a sports game. I don't get pre-drinking, like heavily pre-drinking to a sports match. Mm-hmm. I don't quite understand the thought process there. Like, it's not a movie. It's not like you can pause it and rewind.
At one point on for the 2008 or 2009 Carling Cup final, with my English team, Tottenham Hotspur, in Chelsea.
Ooh.
I went to Library Square at 7 in the morning, or at like 6:30 in the morning, to watch it. And I got there for the doors opening, did not realize it was the Chelsea Supporters Club of Vancouver bar that they had rented out. But at one point, at like 7:30, a woman in an Aston Villa shirt walked in, and there was like, she was like, "Yeah, I'm really excited for this game. You can smell the alcohol on her breath." And I'm like, "So, it's 7:30. Did you pre-drink for this?
Yeah. Are you just on London time, or
you just walked into this bar and it's 7:30 in the morning? What's happening here?"
Yeah. You know what's funny is I wore this bright yellow, and of course our listeners can't see it, but the bright yellow several years ago Arsenal away kit into the last time Arsenal beat Man United, which was a while ago. I walked into the Man United supporters pub, and I knew it was, but I also walked in wearing this jersey as Arsenal scored the third goal. Oh, and it was just so beautiful. Just this, I mean, it's a horrendous jersey to begin with, but in a sea of red, there's just this one yellow and maroon dot, and it's me. Yes. How's everybody doing?
We had at that game, there was like, I think there was about 6 or 7 of Spurs fans in the middle of the bar. You had asked about drinks, and the answer was $11.75 for Stella. And they had something that seemed like a good idea at the time. It was, I looked at it, it was Bailey's and coffee in a collector's mug that was TFC branded.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that seems kind of interesting. And then I thought about it, and it's like, it's $12. I'm about to pay $12 for a shot of Bailey's.
Yeah. And some bad coffee in a mug that's worth 40 cents.
Which kind of like, I was like, well, that is true, but also if that's true, what's the value of a tall can of beer? And I just pushed that thought out of my mind and bought the Stella instead.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, by that same token, is a tall can of Stella $11.75 anywhere on any day? Oh man. Well, I was very excited to just talk about that story, but I guess some people, I mean, I think most people by now know what happened. You and I both predicted Seattle would win. You also, yeah, you opened the door for the ways in which Toronto could win, and let's talk about the game a little bit. I mean, we don't need to go play for play. I think obviously most of our listeners saw the game, and you know, they know as well as anybody else what happened. But what are your thoughts? What are your takeaways on the game overall? Anything that stood out to you?
My prediction in the last episode was that it needed to be more attacking, and specifically that if there was some sort of grand plan for how to do this,
yeah,
that would be the play that TFC used against Columbus was not going to be a success. That strategy was not going to be a success.
Yeah,
and what they ended up doing was running, I think, a 4-3-1-2. Mm-hmm. But what they did was a little surprising. Basically, they converted once the attack began, the fullbacks would come up, and Michael Bradley would drop back to a three back with Michael Bradley as a center back.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be like a 4-3-1-2 that converted into a 3-4-3 basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Michael Bradley's defensive performance was incredibly key to establishing the continuity between defense and attack by dropping into that position. I think control is what exemplified Toronto's performance, because Seattle did get possession, but only late, if at all, did they ever look like they were actually in control. Every time they had the ball, it seemed as though they were exactly where Toronto would like them to be with it.
Yeah, and I mean, I know that was by design as well. I think Greg Vanney put together a master class in tactics there, and that I think one of the game commentators said it, is Brian Schmetzer really doesn't tinker too much with the formations or the lineups, and that definitely played into Toronto's hands, is that this is a team that plays so well together. They can, as we've seen when they've been missing key pieces, they can play in four or five different formations with five or six personnel swap outs and still put on a really good performance. But the, I think it's well established already that Seattle was just a little flat coming out, and as you said, couldn't really maintain any sort of possession. I mean, they could get the first three passes on, but the fifth or sixth seemed to go errant. But the one of the big standouts to me was, and not to be a negative Nelly here about it, was that Nicolas Lodero played, I think, the worst game of soccer he's ever played in his life. And if I was a Seattle fan, I would be absolutely livid with the fact that the big players for Seattle really had absolutely no impact on the game. I mean, Dempsey had an awful lot to do. And I know that it was also the way that Toronto played that sort of made this happen, and they were very quick to close down Lodero. But you also saw the number of times Lodero just gave the ball away poorly, you know, could win the first ball but then couldn't keep it. Or, I mean, his passing was absolutely atrocious. It seemed, I can't remember a time in that game where the ball actually found one of his players.
There were some, I saw a stat of passing in the final third, and there are not that many passes in the Seattle side. And in the Toronto side, it looks like you just took a pen and just like scribbled over it like a 4-year old. There was not a lot to be had in the way of, in the way of ball movement from Seattle. And if they made it, when they made it to the final third, they were kind of, you know, pinned about 30 yards out.
Yeah. For you, what were the positives from Seattle's performance, if any? What could you take away from that? As
it's not new to say that that Tim Melia had an amazing game.
Tim Melia, that was before the game.
Sorry, not Tim Melia. Stephen Fry. I was thinking of great goalkeepers.
That's all right.
And got my wires crossed. Stephen Fry had an amazing game, and I think that after some of the things I was watching at halftime, because Toronto started so strong with a couple of great chances, the ball ends up with Giovinco on the wing after after a breakaway is stopped. A Seattle breakaway is stopped, and the ball goes up to Giovinco, and Giovinco can only get it just, I think it, Fry touches it for a moment and gets it past the far post. There was so much pressure soaked up in the first half that I was really looking to see whether or not Toronto got frustrated, because I think that frustration on the half, the behalf of Giovinco was one of his weaknesses in last year's final. And I was looking at it thinking, if this pressure can be absorbed, Stephen Fry is the sort of the pin on which the whole enterprise rests. And he did quite well for some time, but you can't soak up pressure from a team as talented as Toronto forever.
No. Well, indeed from any team, you know, a great goalkeeper is a fantastic thing to have. And Stephen Fry, I think, certainly earned his paycheck and then some in that game, and he showed up to play. But the problem was is that in front of him, there wasn't much going forward. And I even felt the same for the center backs is, you know, Roman Torres did his job to a T. You know, he was smart. He was physical. He got in there, definitely got in under Altidore's skin, as he often does. And
yeah, Roman Torres did great.
He played it to a T, but when everybody in front just never seemed to be able to pull the ball out of that final third, as you said, I mean, the best defenses in the world cannot just hold out an entire game and just absorb pressure unless the forwards are and the midfielders are helping you out and actually trying to play that ball out. And it actually reminded me, it was like watching Vancouver Whitecaps in the final, because Seattle played like Vancouver played against Seattle.
It was right,
this nervousness, and it's like, okay, we can win the headers and we can clear the ball away, but then there just never really seemed to be much on. There was a few points earlier in the first half, that is, where there was a little bit of space and you saw the potential for the Seattle counterattack. And especially given the numbers that Toronto was committing forward, you knew that that was a bit of a gamble on Vanney's side, because he knows what Seattle can do on the counter. that being said, it's sort of, even when there were points where Seattle seemed to have wide open chances, they just made an absolute mess of it for themselves, or Toronto was able to get back and clean up the pieces.
I think that because of the amount of pressure and the amount of players that Toronto committed forward, Seattle had so many players back that there were a couple of chances I could see where even if they were able to get the ball out or gain possession, you're in a position where you're only dealing with three or four. Even if you're only dealing with four or five Toronto attackers, you have like eight or nine or ten outfield players that are back in their own, 40 yards, and there was no sort of opportunity to break forward. The counterattacks were few and far between.
They were indeed. But as much as we could break down the Seattle performance, we'll get to the Toronto side of things in a second. You also had the good fortune to stumble across two Seattle Sounders fans who were at the game, who actually had a pretty reasoned and nuanced commentary at the half about their team's performance. So do you want to go to that?
Let's hear from them.
First, can I please grab your first and last names?
Scott Godey.
Jackson Godey.
Are you from Seattle?
Yeah, we both are.
When'd you fly in?
Last night.
And I flew in last night from D.C. I go to school there now.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So is it kind of you're on the West Coast? There's a little bit of an opportunity to do that?
I was on the East Coast last year. We didn't come, and we said if they make it to another final, we've got to go. We promised each other that we'd do that. So
even though it's dang cold here.
yeah, for sure. How long have you been going to games?
We've been season ticket holders for Sounders forever.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Before, when they were in USL, too. Yeah.
How exciting was last year's win?
It was great, even though we had to watch it from home, but it was still awesome to watch.
And
if it was before the MLS period, what's it like to sort of make that jump and be able to finally? Because Seattle's been great in the MLS since the first season. But what was it like to finally, I guess, get that trophy?
It was fine. We were due, and it was good to finally get it and get the star there on the jersey.
So what would a second win mean?
Another star.
I think Coach Schmetzer said it best when he said, "Our destiny is a dynasty, and that's what we're going for this year."
And what was the first? What did you think of the first half?
Sounders got to play better. It was definitely a lot more possession for Toronto, and Sounders got to step it up.
Yeah.
People were really impressed with Stephen Fry.
Yeah,
he's the difference maker so far, and if it's like last year, who knows? It may come down to the kicks again.
What has been your overall reflection and feelings or best memories of this season?
Boy, for me, it's the fact that Sounders were able to play through so much diversity. You know, a lot of injuries, a lot of people gone for international games, and they still were able to persevere and come back and make it here again.
The big addition is Clint Dempsey. What is it like to finally, I guess, see him back in the lineup?
I think that Klimt brings a little extra, but more importantly, it's having the full strength of our midfield and our defense. That's our strength, and our forwards can make stuff happen, but it's our midfield having Roldan and Svensson in there is really what makes the difference.
What's your prediction for the second half?
Schmetzer's going to send a few more guys forward, and we're going to put one in about the 70th minute.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much.
Okay, well, I thought for a halftime commentary, I mean, obviously I had the benefit of knowing the final result, but I thought that was a pretty fair assessment, and I hate to give Seattle credit for anything, but I do appreciate the Sounders fans do understand the game. And I think that's a pretty fair assessment of what needed to happen, and yet didn't.
I do want to say the word that I'm, as I was last year, impressed with the Sounders traveling support. It's a big trip to make with a week's notice.
Yeah.
Unless you have a little bit more of an inkling, and they always got fans that are committed to make it to this thing, and there were the section was packed. They had strong support. You can never. When you're in the section, you can only hear that section. So I didn't hear the most out of them,
yeah.
but uh, but you could see them. They had a big display themselves, and they had their own banners and Tifa. So that was really cool to see.
Mm-hmm. So
I think one question, because these two players, I feel like the front six of Dempsey, Svensson, Roldan, Rodriguez, Lodero, and Bruin is pretty defensible as a lineup that they've put out before, but
yep.
I think that the contributions they brought in Jordan Morris and Nuhu Tolo as subs, and I think that Nuhu especially has had such important contributions to the team over the course of the year that I wonder if you how you thought of the starting lineup decision on the part of Seattle.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't overly surprising. You know, I knew that obviously, I knew that Morris had not played in a while and was his fitness was still a little bit questionable. And obviously Will Bruin has been on a bit of a tear as of late. So it made sense that you'd see both him and Dempsey out at the same time as we have seen a few times this season.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's so much a question of, the lineup is just that tactics wise, and I think Greg Vanney said it too in his post game that whatever game plan Seattle came in with just kind of got ripped apart in early on by Toronto.
Yes.
And then just fell apart, and they just couldn't seem to, they didn't really have time to think. Seattle's a team that does like to settle into games a little bit, and that's where we've seen some perhaps less than exciting results from them. Or some questionable results from them is that they do tend to like to find their rhythm early on. Toronto came out flying at them and really, really put the pressure on early. And Seattle just seemed to get a little bit nervous, and that seemed to translate to just about everything else that happened on the pitch. Aside from some very calm moments from Stephen Fry, which is what you expect. You know, he's a top goalkeeper. He's done his homework. He knows what to do. There was no luck in anything that he did. He was always in the right place. As we mentioned, Roman Torres had a fantastic game as well. And there was moments from guys like Svensson and, I'm running out of names to think of for who did well. There was moments of like possibility from Seattle, but I just think that also take nothing away from Toronto is that it wasn't an easy game for them. They had a half dozen half chances that they weren't able to put away. And as you talked about in terms of frustration, Giovinco, I thought, had another really poor performance. Aside from the sequence that led to the Altidore goal, he really looked out of sorts and he looked frustrated for much of the match. And, you know, I don't know. It makes me question the future of Giovinco at Toronto. Not necessarily next season. I'm not saying you sell a player because they have a string of games where they don't really produce much. But I was surprised at how much of a non-factor he was. And the fact that really his major contribution seemed to be trying to win a penalty, which was never in a million years going to be a penalty. And he just sort of, especially, it was weird because in the second half, when Toronto started to assert their dominance, he seemed like he got even more frustrated by the fact that it wasn't quite falling to him and he wasn't able to pull anything off. And as much, everybody likes to talk about in these big games, your star players, your big money signings come up and they perform. Altidore is a perfect example of that. Giovinco, I think, choked. Similarly to how Lodero choked. He was really just not fully switched on. And, you know, I heard his name maybe three or four times in that whole match from the commentators in terms of him actually having the ball and doing anything with it.
You do leave the game with the impression that he didn't need to be there. Which is a hard thing, to say, but that he didn't really necessarily bring a lot. There was the one. I also think that as everybody knows that he has great set pieces, I think they limited Giovinco's ability to collect set pieces. There were 9 fouls, but very few of them were sort of in range. There was one, I think, in the first half, mm-hmm. that didn't really take the way where he the distance was very. I felt the distance was over 10 yards, and he got it into the hit it right in the wall.
Yeah,
and that was one of the. I thought that he had a huge. Where he had a great chance. There was also that other one in the first half as well, but he was responsible for perhaps one of the most humorous moments of the game for me, which is he was down. The play moves. It's in the second half. The play moves back up the pitch towards Toronto's goal, and Giovinco believes that he's a bit injured, or he's injured and is lying on the pitch as though he's waiting for a stoppage of play from the referee, rolling hither and thither. And Stephen Fry comes up to help him stretch his cramp in the middle of play, grabs his leg and brings it up and helps him stretch his cramp out so that he can stand.
Yeah. Yeah. One, I like that too, is because then Giovinco really didn't seem to know what to do with that either. It's like he was clearly... wanted to get the call, didn't get the call, and so was now just wasting time, and was not expecting the goalkeeper to come running out while the game is still playing on to help out. And then you could sort of see a sort of, like, an admission of guilt from Giovinco as he sort of patted Stephen Fry, just to be like, yeah,
you got me,
like... And fair, you know, as much as it's fun to hate the villains of the game, and it's much fun as it is to have the villains... you know, I get it. I think Giovinco is obviously very invested in the team. You know, he went out before the match with the groundskeeper to bury a little good luck charm in BMO Field.
Yes.
It didn't seem to work for Giovinco on the night, but certainly worked for his team. A question I wanted...
As we're talking about frustration, I do think that... Toronto gave up nothing in the way of fouls. 3 fouls, all of them near the center line.
Yeah.
It was an incredibly disciplined performance.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. I was actually quite surprised by it, that there wouldn't be more and it wouldn't be a little bit more chippy. It was just so clear that they went out there with a particular game plan and were purely focused on that. And it was mm-hmm. so frustrating to Seattle. But... you know, really the only time you saw tempers flare was between Altidore and Torres, which there's a history there. And I also appreciate that when the final whistle blew, you know, they're the first two players to go over and shake hands and embrace. And, you know, it's a professional grudge. And
right.
I'm sure the guys could grab a drink together and have lots to talk about and not hate each other. But they're two big dudes that like to get in each other's faces. You know, and not that anybody's going to start calling Giovinco's dives anytime soon or actually carding them, but I think that was, if you had to dig and search for a reason for a Toronto yellow, that would really be the only one. Because as you said, everybody else put in a thoroughly professional performance. I also, an unsung hero of this game is the referee, because the amount of stuff that he let go and just let the game play on, and you constantly had people... going down and looking up at him from both sides, and he just, I love the hand motion of just the get up, like it's not happening, play on. I don't know about you, I mean I thought he had an absolutely fantastic game. Aside from whatever bizarre thing happened in sort of like around the 85th minute with the corner, where somebody was checking something and the corner took 2 or 3 minutes to come, but there was
my
no real
is there might have been pushing. There might have been pushing in the box area.
Yeah.
I think that was where it was coming from.
But I can appreciate how, as a Seattle fan, when you actually finally have some bit of momentum, to have to now wait upwards of 2 minutes to take your corner,
mm-hmm.
like, it was kind of ridiculous. But anyway, aside from I thought he had the referee also deserves a nod of praise for the performance.
You were talking about Altidore, and when we were discussing Giovinco and what happens to him now, I think that he's still very vital to the overall effort in this season, especially the regular season, because regardless of his impact on one particular game, the danger he posed over the course of the season was very important in putting him into the position to come into the final.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think, as much as I don't think he was ever not recognized, I think that Josie Altidore became a star in Toronto.
no kidding.
Perhaps for the first time over the course of the conference semifinal this game.
Yeah, absolutely. And well-deserved. Obviously, the goal was fantastic. It was a striker's finish. He pulled. There's very few ways of getting a ball past Stephen Fry, and he did exactly the right thing. And Stephen Fry's positioning was fantastic, 1v1, but Altidore did exactly the right thing, pulled him out, and just a very deft flick of the foot pushed it, you know, the opposite direction past Fry. And you even see in the replay, Fry gets his hand up. Like, Fry reacts properly. He just reacts slightly too late. And it, as beautiful as a goal as it is, I feel like people don't quite give Altidore the credit for how difficult that is to do. I mean, when a goalkeeper is rushing out at you anyway and closing down the space, but then also reacts correctly. Fry knew what he was going to do. Altidore was still able to pull it off. So it really is a world-class finish and a spectacular goal. And you could see that even in the celebration. I mean, we were talking last week about doubting his fitness and could that possibly be a major Achilles heel for Toronto. And Altidore did what Altidore does, and that's silence people with a performance. He went out, he played patiently, he played the game the way that he likes to play the game, and he got his chance and he took it. And as much as I can fully admit when I'm wrong, I'm not surprised that I'm being proven wrong by Josie Altidore. And I will continue as a fan to hate him and boo him every time he touches a ball in BC Place, but you know, that performance was pure class. It shows as much as a striker can be a villain and you can complain about a player all you want, that was an absolutely professional performance and somebody that just really did take it to heart. There was no way he was missing that game. There was no way he wasn't scoring a goal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not surprising that he got his rewards for it. Everything he receives from here on out is justly deserved.
Despite what we were talking about in terms of the numerical advantage and in the obvious sort of lack of momentum Seattle had coming into the final 20 minutes of the game, it was still clear that there was a little bit of mathematical, I think, nervousness in BMO Field because everybody got that despite the fact that they hadn't generated much. That even one moment of skill could make it happen, and they had near complete possession through 1 5-minute interval in that period of time. I think that the second goal by Victor Vasquez was so crucial to ending that tenseness.
Absolutely, had that not been a goal, and just a weird one too, where it gets rattled off the post and, you know, Vasquez is just there and basically humps it in with his hips. If that doesn't go in, the final 5 minutes is all Seattle throwing the pressure up, getting numerous corners, you know, in many ways really trying to play for the repeat result and take it to extra time. Yeah,
it definitely still looked possible. You knew that they were a dangerous team, even if the run of play hadn't indicated it so far.
Absolutely. So I wanted to ask you a question, and then I have a sort of a hero of sorts who also weighs in with his assessment of it. But for you, who is your man of the match for this game? For from both teams.
I really have to say that I think that, Victor Vasquez was key in I think having a calm approach and in keeping everything organized. I think that like the conference final, there were a few early shaky situations. There are a few passes that you could criticize, but over the course of the game, so much of the attack went through him, and he did not seem frustrated, and he was able to sort of exemplify that calm, professional approach.
Hmm. Interesting. Not who I thought you were going to say, but I agree with that assessment. So I just put this question out to the Twitterverse to see who responded, and then I thought, well, I'll ask a couple of people specifically and see if anyone responds. So I asked Marius Ravda, the former Whitecaps goalkeeper coach, who his man of the match was, and he replied. And he said, I was going to say it was Stefan Fry, but it would be too predictable that I picked a goalkeeper. My man of the match is Michael Bradley, the dictator.
Yeah.
And I have to agree.
I
think Michael Bradley, you know, and I was not surprised by it at all. And we've talked about this before. We talked about it in the last episode with the amount of criticism he's faced with the U.S. national team missing out on the World Cup. He played, I mean, in a sense, I feel like there wasn't really a position he didn't play or a role he didn't play throughout this whole playoff run. And I've seen many great Michael Bradley performances, and I've always, again, hated him and admired the way that he played. And this was him. I really felt like he barely put a foot wrong the entire match. He was back as that third center back when he needed to be. He was quick in transition. The passes were on. The vision was there. And again, you have to give the coach credit to know where to play their players and also allow them some room to express themselves. But it was really hard watching that game to not make a case for Michael Bradley being one of the best midfielders in MLS.
You're absolutely right. I take it all back.
But I know your point about Victor Vasquez makes a lot of sense as well. I mean, I'm not trying to say that you're wrong just because Marius and I agree.
But it's still a strong, strong assessment, because the rolling switching back and forth is not easy.
No.
And I think that it was incredibly well done in creating that sort of red wall 30-40 yards out. Was key to creating the frustration in the first half for Seattle that they were unable to get anything going.
Yeah, well, and that, you know, for me the big thing was also, I mean, there was the vision in the passes, but even just the tackles that you expect from a player in Michael Bradley's position. But the fact that it's not just a tackle and then the ball goes away, and we've criticized a lot of central defenders over the past couple of months who, they win the first tackle and they break up play, but they're not really able to do anything with that. Michael Bradley wins the tackle, keeps the ball, sees the open player, makes the pass. The pass gets to the player, and then all of a sudden something's on. All of those things that he can do so well, I mean, he really did everything that we know Michael Bradley can do well. He played perfectly in that match. And it was, you know, as much as, you know, I'm always going to cheer against Toronto. It was hard not to, and indeed Michael Bradley, it was hard not to really just go, Michael Bradley deserves this. The whole team deserves it. But you just go, you know, if they lose this, I'm just going to feel heartbroken for Michael Bradley, who has been everywhere, making all the right plays, making all the right tackles, reading the positions properly, keeping the team calm, seeing the open teammates, and really leading by example, which I think helped everybody play better. I thought there was great performances all around out of players who have been good all season, but not great. And Michael Bradley playing in behind them, and in some cases playing in front of them, makes them that much better.
That's right. Also, a championship for former Vancouver Whitecaps Stephen Bateshore, which is exciting.
It was exciting. For a second, too, I thought he was going to let a screamer go from distance and possibly seal the deal. And I mean, I wasn't overly surprised that it went over, but that was an example of the effectiveness of Toronto's attack, is that the fullbacks are always going to get chances and be involved in the play. And again, I'm not surprised, and I've said this for a long time, Stephen Betashore is by far the best right back in MLS, worth every penny, and Toronto has just capitalized on him so well. Because you can play him as that fourth man, but if they push to that sort of five at the back, he really sort of does become a winger, and just very quietly goes about his work, but he was causing all kinds of problems against some very good Seattle Sounders defense.
Absolutely. I think that when you talk about what it means to the players, I think that fortunately or unfortunately, Seattle really had nothing. Seattle loses nothing, or I guess not loses nothing, because it would have been wonderful to have a championship.
Yeah.
But there wasn't much to gain for Seattle, because nobody, you know, everybody still knows this team is good. Everybody still knows these players are good. They were the champions. Mm-hmm. There was no sort of new. It would have almost had a sense of excess to it had they won. Whereas, you know, there were a lot of people, especially after the elimination of the U.S. men's national team from World Cup qualifying.
Yeah.
I think Bradley and Altidore specifically, that's something to prove.
Absolutely. Any question about pressure on players, I think, you know, when you saw what it meant to them when they won, I think kind of negates that when players are like, oh, no, there's no pressure. Of course there was pressure. There was always pressure on Toronto. There was never much pressure on Seattle. And, you know, it's interesting because my major question kind of going forward is, and not to take anything away from the final game, but what next for both of these teams? Because Seattle has a very good team, and I certainly don't think you get rid of Lodeiro just because he had a bad game in the final and wasn't really a factor. But you kind of go, what does Seattle need to be champions? Mm-hmm. And for Toronto, you kind of go, well, they can't keep everybody, right? It's MLS. Someone's got to go. But
yeah,
who do you cut, and how do you keep things fresh when you have such a strong squad? What pieces mm-hmm. are needed? And that's the only reason why I bring up the Giovinco question. Not because I think that he should be sold or I think that he will. But when you look around at the performances, you kind of go, well, how many changes to that lineup and the system do you really make over the off season? That you do sort of get a sense of, and of course, the off season can be both short and long, and teams will add to their rosters. But this Toronto side is just so unstoppable. Like, you don't really get a sense of like, oh, but it would be great if they had a truly great center defensive mid or a truly great winger. Or a truly great striker. They can't run the same system forever, but where they're at right now, you kind of go, what would you change for 2018, really?
The first thing to think about is the expansion draft, yes. Which will take place on Tuesday.
Yeah.
So that's going to happen real quick. They have to, the rosters will, the exposed rosters, are the exposures already made? I'm not sure. But you got to look at, you know, they're going to lose somebody.
Yeah.
And so the question is, who do you expose? And then, you know, if you've got to let a marquee player go and you've got to pick somebody, if for other reasons, financial reasons, you've got to let a marquee player go, but you also have to let a player like, SB Nation blog, Waking the Red, thought that Drew Moore could be the one to go. He's incredibly important to the defense. And if you're trying to find a player that that you could slot in that will sort of set the tone on offense, and you're also trying to replace somebody who is also an unsung hero elsewhere on the field, it's going to be challenging from a club culture perspective.
Yeah, when, and especially for a team that seems so tightly knit, that everybody does genuinely seem to get along and have this great chemistry in it, and that can't be understated about Toronto. This isn't just Toronto going out and spending a crap ton of money. If that won championships, then Atlanta would have won the championship this year. That, of course, money always plays a factor in it, but they've built a team. They've built an actual team, and so it's it's kind of the same question I have about Seattle, really, is you go, well, what do you change? I mean, you can say there's a dozen players possibly available that are better than a Will Bruin or a Clint Dempsey, who I believe both had 12 goals this season. But you go, sure, but at what cost? What's their experience in MLS? And do you change a thing that's working, or just kind of do the same again and find a couple of other pieces to hopefully augment it?
I think that Seattle, I don't know. One thing we haven't talked a lot about in the run up has been, just because Toronto did not look bulletproof throughout the playoffs, there was no sense of Toronto as kind of a, even though they had such an important season, a barrier you have to find your way around, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, there was no thought of, like, well, what is a team going to do to solve the problem of Toronto? Like,
yeah, yeah.
They seem solvable.
Yeah,
to a certain extent.
Exactly.
They weren't, but...
No, I agree.
Your free agents of the two teams, Lamar Nagel and Brad Evans for Seattle, are out of contract.
Hmm.
And Drew Moore for Toronto. And Jason Hernandez and Stephen Betashore will be out of contract. People think that leaving Drew Moore, this was the article that I was just reading, that leaving Drew Moore unsigned before the expansion draft will make it very unlikely that he will be picked.
Right.
And then they'll try to sign him right after.
Yeah, and possibly even for Betashore. I mean, I'm sure his price will come down for next season because he's getting on in years, but that could be another sort of strategic thing. Or as well as we've seen, and we'll talk more about it next week, but teams will also be strategic in the players that they sign, and then they will leave those players open in the expansion draft. So you buy a budget player that you have a good feeling that other teams are going to want, and then you leave them unprotected as one of your unprotected spots. Another team buys them up so that they don't go after other key assets on your team.
There's so much wheeling and dealing.
I know, it is. Yeah, we'll get to that next week, but there's a couple of examples already in today's 4-hour trade window where there definitely seem to be some questionable moves about players who are more or less near retirement and getting brought in who could be gone next week.
Is this something that you would see? Now, let's talk a little bit more about that later on.
Yeah.
The one thing that I wanted to talk about before leaving the question of the final was, much has been said about sort of the angle of TFC moving from a really sorry position, you know, quote unquote, worst club in the world or whatever is the MLS front page article blared, to champions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they haven't been, it's been clear that they haven't been basement dwellers for some time, but I think that there is a strain of feeling among Canadian soccer, and especially Canadian soccer in Ontario, that is has a certain amount of fatalism to it. You
sure.
know, like
yeah.
that failure is, if not assured, then at least expected.
Yeah.
Eventually, what do you think this does for TFC's credibility in the league, in the local market, and for, I guess, Canadian soccer in general?
So I'll answer the smaller question first, and I'll raise you one with it. Because
yes.
The question I was going to ask you is this the greatest MLS side ever? So in answering your question, I would say it is, without a doubt, unquestionably, with an exclamation mark. And I genuinely feel like over the next 5-10 years, you are going to see that record beat. I don't think this is a thing that Toronto is going to hold on to forever. But they've written the book now on how to achieve the previously unachievable. And, I mean, clearly, just for the club and for Ontario soccer, this is a massive, massive, massive move forward. The pieces that are still missing is significant Canadian contributions to that.
Yes.
It was great to see Osorio with the game time. I thought he had a fantastic game. But the question still remains about development of Canadian players. And we've really yet to see significant involvement from Canadian players in Toronto FC for some time now.
Now, Osorio had an early exit.
Yeah, was subbed out. There's lots of ways of looking at that. I think it will obviously... It raises the profile of the team. It raises the profile of Canadian soccer. I think a lot of people on the West Coast are going to say it doesn't really matter, and how can you even call this a Canadian team because virtually no Canadians play on it. All the criticisms that could be leveled at just about any team. I think Montreal does a slightly better job of it. Mm-hmm. But... It can only help. Like, this is a fantastic achievement for the club. It will have trickle-down effects. It's not going to solve all the problems in Canadian soccer. It doesn't mean that the fatalism has been cured by any stretch. But sometimes that's what you need, right? Is like, and I don't want to overdo it here with the metaphor, but that is kind of a Canadian thing, right? Is the, like, assume we're going to lose... but we stick in there anyway. Toronto was once rated the worst team in the world, as you said. Sort of unofficially, but...
Yeah.
Had a very...
It was a sorry time.
Yeah, and it was a very sorry time, had a very poor reputation, and what compounded on that was they weren't just a bad team, they were a bad team that spent a lot of money, and... regardless of where they spent money, just never seemed to get it quite right. Or they'd have good players that they wouldn't play. Those good players would leave and do fantastically at other clubs. It was just all bad all around.
I want to especially highlight the unfortunateness of signing players like Dwayne De Rosario, who was a league standout for DC, and Julian De Guzman, who had a great career in Spain.
Yeah.
There were other international players too. I mean, like you know, Torsten Frings didn't turn out, and there were previous attempts to make big signings before the bloody a big deal. But it's like that was almost more demoralizing was the fact that you found the best Canadian players in the world to play for TFC, and it wasn't great.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think those are two different questions, really. I don't think it's TFC's responsibility to solely solve that problem. Canadian players need more opportunities to play. At the same time, it's got to happen at the development level, and it's not going to happen overnight. It's not just a case of buying a bunch of Canadian players, putting them on the same team. Much fuss has been made about Atiba Hutchinson and bringing him in, but you know, even that it's kind of a hard argument to make because you go, you're successful in a very different type of league and it's taken this long for him to be successful. Just bringing him to MLS is not going to necessarily mean that he does well. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's so many factors that go into it that fans and commentators just don't see. Yeah, it's hard to say what fixes it, but... you know, for Ontario soccer and for Canadian soccer, this definitely is a win. I'm not going to take the cynical attitude that just because there's not that many Canadian starters for Toronto that this doesn't do something to aspire to. You know, and that goes for all sports, right? Like, if you're a Toronto Maple Leafs fan, you know, you're not necessarily just looking at the kid from Toronto or Ontario who made it into the team. You're looking at these international signings. You're looking at the young players that come from other places as well. That's sort of the weird globalism of sports. You know, great heroes, it doesn't really matter where they're from. It matters what jersey they're wearing. And for Toronto, you have great ambassadors to the club. That criticisms of Giovinco aside, he obviously cares about the club. And... shows that it matters. He's not just here to retire and, you know, relive some sort of glory days he could have had in Italy. He really cares. And young players see that and they want to emulate it.
There was clearly, I think, buy-in from the larger community in Toronto in terms of a lot of support from City Hall. John Tory wearing the scarf, as always.
Yeah.
There will be a championship parade on Monday.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people are taking notice to a certain degree in terms of thinking of this as a major achievement as opposed to just something that happens to be happening in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
When players like Jozy Altidore or Michael Bradley are calling this the best city in the world, Torontonians accept that flattery and enjoy it.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think that TFC's success, because I don't think a lot of people even, you know, as good as that season was, I don't think that there was a level of excitement approaching the offseason similar to the Toronto Blue Jays' season to a year or two ago.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of people were surprised, that I speak to that were from Toronto and had moved elsewhere, were like, oh, TFC is good now?
Yeah.
And in Toronto, as Canada does in general, loves to be celebrated in the United States.
Yes.
And as good as the rest of the season was and as important as the milestone is, I almost feel like, you know, being the MLS Cup champions endears the club to Toronto more as that was the first time in the course of the season that I felt in that post-match celebration that I felt TFC really meant something to Toronto.
Yeah.
Not that you know, people don't like TFC or anything, but that it might have a significant impact on the way that the city sees itself. I don't think there was another point in the season where that was the case.
No, I agree. I think that's a very astute observation, is that and I know I've sort of taken some cracks at Toronto's supporter base, but you know, it's hard. You wouldn't necessarily pick Toronto as a real hot soccer market, and considering how poorly Toronto did for the first 8 years it was in MLS, you can hardly blame them. I'm excited to see what comes next. As much as this is such a fantastic achievement for Canadian soccer, and you know, it's a first in many ways. Winning the treble and the historic wins and accomplishments that Toronto's done will sort of overshadow the fact that this is the first Canadian club to win an MLS Cup, and you can bet that Montreal and Vancouver are taking notes about this, and that clearly if Toronto can do it, if Toronto can turn it around and put in the right system to win, any team can.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree that it's always sort of seemed like, you know, I've spent some time in Toronto, nobody seems to know who TFC is or really care. And that's purely anecdotally, but my hope is, on a much smaller scale, for Toronto, they have a winning team, and it's a team that now they pack that stadium every game next season.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what continues to grow Canadian soccer, not just a sort of sense of pride off the field that, okay, finally a Toronto team won, is that people get curious and come out to games and engage with MLS because there's actually a team worth watching. And it's a great story as well.
The quality of the sports story is it's among, I love these 1 year, 2 year stories. Similar to Andy Murray's failure at Wimbledon against Roger Federer a couple of years back in 2012, and then coming back to win in 2013. The impact, the statistical unlikelihood of returning to a final. I think I saw that it was the first win on second appearance since 2003. when the LA Galaxy did it. It's really hard to mentally keep yourself in that same position after losing in the final. I said in the last episode that it was getting to this point was a feeling of spite,
yeah.
You know, or like, you know, a triumph of sporting spite to make that happen.
100%. And they played like that all season long. Toronto played like they had something to prove all season long. And as much as people can say, Greg Vanney said, no, that's not the case. They came into this season with the attitude of, we want a repeat. We want to be there in the final. And actually, you know what? We don't even want to play another team. We want a repeat of, we want a do-over with Seattle. They bested us, but they worked, they had a goal in sight, and I don't think ever really faltered from it. And many people said last year, this time, this will either galvanize or break the team. And they were brilliant in the way that they used it to galvanize them and just said, okay, it starts tomorrow. The project is we get back to the final. We beat Seattle or we beat whoever, but this cup is something that we're going to take. And everybody had the odds stacked against them until it just seems so obvious. And I think that's also why, not to be apologists for our predictions, but that's why you and I were, I think, hesitant to just say, of course Toronto wins, because as an outsider, you don't know what is in a player's head, and you see the weaknesses and you see the tactical things that aren't quite working, rather than the fact that, and it's not to say the game was won by pure passion or anything like that, but you have to get yourself there in the first place. And there was a lot of teams that played fantastic seasons this year that then just sort of shit the bed in the playoffs and ended up out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Toronto, although at times made it hard for themselves, never really faltered from that vision. There was just no way, come hell or high water, they weren't getting to that final game.
After the first half seemed worryingly similar in terms of the amount and quality of chances being generated without a goal,
mm-hmm.
I think that Jozy Altidore's goal was so important narratively in terms of, I turned around and said, it's going to be different this time. You know, there's the sense of hope in this. It's going to be different this time.
Yeah.
It's not going to be like last time.
Yeah.
You know, and that people benefit from that feeling of, you know, you go in with the game plan, you have an amazing, you know, tactical strategy, you're executing, you're not giving up chances. But the assurance that it will be better this time,
mm-hmm.
Doesn't come until that goal happens. And, you know, we're not going to penalties on 0-0 again.
Yeah.
Even late on when there was, you know, there was more pressure from Seattle, it would have still been different if it was 1-1 on penalties.
Yeah.
Just the act after the parallel seasons of changing the script, finally, of bending, you know, you can change the past.
Yeah. But I'll say this, and as I'm sure many other people have said, if that goal doesn't go in from Altidore, I think it's a very different game.
Yeah.
They so desperately needed that goal at that time from that player, which mm-hmm. I think can only serve to further underscore the achievement of it. Is that goal has to go in, and it has to come from Altidore, and it has to come at that time. Otherwise, it is backs to the wall. The ball off the post and the play and Vasquez just being in the right place to just somehow get it in. Maybe doesn't happen because your focus is a little off and the nerves are frayed. You know, again, Altidore had an extremely difficult job to do, but as he does, made it look easy. Which helps your whole team, right?
Yeah, the nervous brain still says there can be a goal, but when Altidore came off and everybody got the chance to applaud him, his knee probably, you know, cobbled together by cortisone and kinesio tape.
Yeah,
I think that was I don't think that there was a feeling where I was that this was going to go any other way.
Yeah. Well, I think that about says it. I mean, it took so long to get here. We're here. It was done.
That's the season.
That's the season. And well done to Toronto, and congratulations to the supporters. I was especially thinking of, it's hard not to be sentimental about these things, but I think about people who were season's ticket holders from day one and watched Toronto just fail so hard for so long. Regardless of how, and I know that there's going to be Cascadian supporters that are maybe not a fans of this commentary, but it's well-deserved, and I'm very excited, not for the club necessarily, but for the fans of the team that have stuck it out for so long. This so rarely happens in sports that you see a team that struggles like this and then eventually becomes champions and indeed becomes the team to beat. They are now the greatest team in MLS history. I think that's very hard to debate. If you're a person who spent 5 years watching Toronto at the bottom of the table, that's got to feel good, and
Yeah, sports can make people happy. It's important to remember that, because sometimes it can feel like it makes us mad, or it makes us sad, or feel hopeless, or whatever else. But sports can cause joy in people's lives, and that's what I saw. You know, after the game, and walking through Liberty Village, walking in the tunnel that goes underneath the GO train between BMO Field and Liberty Village.
Yeah.
And just the joy of people in the tunnel banging on the plastic boards on the side of the train tunnel. People were very excited, and you're right, well earned. You know, it should be a give and take in sports, and sometimes some fan bases give a little bit more than they receive.
But yeah, at the very least, I mean, anybody can say what they want about this team and their style of play, but in terms of the supporters, I think you just say, celebrate on, and we'll see you in 2018.
Absolutely.
So we're gonna leave you now with a few scenes from that actual final whistle blow, and you calling it on the final, and then we'll be back next week to talk about what's happening in the off season. We'll do some off season shows and keep you updated.
There's lots going on in terms of the expansion draft and players becoming available. Where can we find you online?
You can find me online at That's So MLS. Where can we find you online?
You can find me at Team Bates, www.team-bates.com. Go to whatahaller.com for all of their wonderful soccer insight. You can find this podcast on iTunes. Please give us a subscribe, a rate and review would be nice as well.
Yeah, that's a thing. We should probably tell people to subscribe to our show and stuff. Make it easier for them.
You can find it everywhere else, but on wherever great podcasts are found. But give us a little rate and review. That'd be nice.
Indeed, and also like talk to us, ask us questions. The off season is beginning. We will be there. We will be talking about it. We'll be following it. And so if you're not sure about what's going on or you want to pose a question, please do, so that we've got stuff to talk about.
Sounds great. And until the I guess we'll see you in another week's time after we know a little bit more about what Rock is like.
Indeed. Well, until next time, have a clean final and don't get sent off.
I won't.
364 days after losing on penalties, Toronto FC have completed the greatest regular season, the greatest season in MLS history, by beating Seattle Sounders 2-0 at BMO Field in a performance where they were able to control possession in defense so that Seattle was never truly in control. Everyone is losing their minds, because after their 11th season, TSC are champions.